We went live with the new Until Gone site, which we can talk about some of the software stuff we did here in a second, on September 1st. And I can tell you, Brad, if I showed you the detailed financials, you'll see them start to grow through the summer. And then there's this inflection point, September 1st, where they just kick up and you start seeing this nice steady growth curve. And I think a lot of it had to do with, we made changes over the summer to the Yugster site to clean it up, make it a little bit more polished. But there's only so much that we were able to do. Once we went to the new site, which was a completely revamped look and feel and brand, I think it, for all the customers that we were bringing in, it just gave them confidence.
Hi, folks. It's the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Dast. Quiet Light Brokerage is the leader in helping entrepreneurs build, buy, and sell their online businesses. Since 2007, we have helped thousands buy and sell online businesses. And now, we're putting our extensive knowledge in your earbuds with our trademark relentless honesty and a few laughs along the way.
What would you say if a guy walked in for an interview without a shirt and I hired him? What would you say?
He must have had on some really nice pants.
And now, here's Joe and Mark.
One of the darkest periods in the history of Quiet Light Brokerage happened around 2011. I wasn't sure what I was going to do with Quiet Light at that time. And due to some personal situations going on with health issues with a family member of mine, I took my eye off the ball of Quiet Light for a little bit of time and found ourselves in a position where, frankly, we didn't have a lot of money coming in. We had a lot more money going out and not a lot of deal flow at the same time. It was at that point in time when a great listing, a great business literally just fell in my lap. And I was able to get that listing on the market, get it sold within a few days, or at least found a buyer within a few days, and really represented kind of a life vest for me, which really helped bring Quiet Light Brokerage back off the brink of extinction. One of the great things about this business that I love is seeing some of the companies that we touch early on grow and sometimes come back to us. When I originally started Quiet Light Brokerage, my previous company that I'd sold came back through Quiet Light. I sold it again. I actually ended up selling that company a total of three times, which was pretty fascinating to do. Today, we don't have Joe on the introduction. We have Brad, because Brad talked to one of his previous clients, a buyer that just closed an acquisition, and they bought the business that served that life vest as a life vest for me back in 2011. Brad, how was the conversation with Richard?
You know, it was really great. I didn't actually know that background. I think you sent me an email and said, hey, I got a lot on my plate. This is a good listing. Do you want to take a peek at it and see if you can put a value on it and help them get it sold? So I didn't know all that backstory. I just knew that you had sold it once previously. So it was one of those situations where we had a guy that was in Richard, the buyer. We had a guy that was looking for an investment. He had inquired on a little tiny listing that I had out at the time. It was like $100,000, and came to the conclusion that it wasn't a good fit. But I had picked up on that this guy was like a serious M&A guy. Like, I could already tell from the get-go, like, why is this guy looking at a $100,000 listing? This guy's supposed to be looking at much larger listings than this. And so I was a little surprised and ended up floating him the details of this listing that we had for a daily deal site that kind of needed someone with the ability to kind of handle a lot of moving parts. I felt like he seemed like the perfect personality for it. And so I floated it his way, and the next day he sent me an LOI, and it was just really smooth sailing from there on out from his, you know, side of things. He just was a really great buyer to work with. And so I wanted to bring him on the podcast because I think he's done several things that have been really interesting with that company.
Yeah, how is his due diligence process different than, say, your average buyer out there?
Yeah, so, you know, when we do these deals, they always look a little bit different. After we get an LOI, we are involved sometimes a lot in the due diligence process. Sometimes we're not involved very much at all. We have kind of standard folders and things that people want to look at, bank statements or proofs out of PayPal or your credit card provider, things like that, where people can kind of verify the numbers. in the case with Richard, I found out after he'd gone under LOI, he had done like $200 million in acquisitions in the corporate world. He was a very seasoned and experienced M&A guy. I can't remember how many transactions he had done, but he had been responsible for some very large deals for a publicly traded company. And so when he put his diligence request together, he said, "Hey, I'm working on my diligence request." And I sent them over to the seller. I think the seller about passed out. There was nothing wrong with it. It was very thorough. But when you get these really experienced guys, sometimes you think, oh, that means it's going to be a piece of cake for the seller. But it doesn't always mean that. Sometimes if you got a seller that's really done, it's kind of like, hey, I'm just ready to move on. I don't want to look at it anymore. It can be a little bit of a challenge. And so we definitely dealt with that a little bit on this one, where we've got a really seasoned buyer who had a very nice, you know, thorough packet of diligence information that he wanted gathered. And then we had a seller that was really ready to be finished. And when he got the packet, I think he felt like, oh my goodness, I just put all this work into getting the listing ready. Now we're going to go through this diligence process that is way more exhausting than what I did whenever I bought it on the front end. But honestly, it was two great guys. The seller was a great seller. The buyer was a great buyer. And they worked very well together. And I think they've continued to be friends post-transaction. So,
yeah. And the seller that you worked with was the buyer when I sold this business, and still remains one of my favorite people that I've worked with at Quiet Light. He's a fantastic guy. I think people sometimes get intimidated, especially on the sell side, when they see these really long due diligence lists. But I've learned over the years, and I don't know how you feel about this, Brad, but I've learned over the years that a thorough due diligence list is a good sign. It's usually a sign that the buyer is extraordinarily serious, because look, you have to generate all the information. The buyer has to digest that information, and that's really tough. And it also reduces the risk after the sale, right? Because if they're doing a thorough due diligence, the chances of something coming back on you after are pretty small, because they've done their homework.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I actually tell my sellers all the time, if they are complaining about the due diligence process, I always tell them the work you're putting in now is saving you headache later. You know, if you're going to go ahead and give them all the things that they need today, they're not going to be the type of buyer that's coming back to you and saying, "Hey man, I really need you to help me with this or that. I need to take advantage of these hours that we carved into the APA and train me on these different things." And I definitely have seen the transactions where they don't ask for much, and then I find out later that the buyers had to come back to the seller several times asking for things. And it seems like it is a better situation to just kind of lay all the cards on the table and do the work up front and kind of have the ability to be done with the business and kind of transition to your next thing.
All right. That's a lot of chit chat on our part. Let's go ahead and listen to the interview.
Welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast. I'm your host today, Brad Wayland, and we are joined today by Richard Bell. Hey Richard, Brad. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks. Nice to see you.
Good. Yeah. So we've been doing this series of podcasts on folks that have bought something from Quiet Light, and now we're kind of following up with them, seeing how things went, learning about why they bought, you know, what they learned early on, what the challenges are. And so today's kind of one of those profiles. And this one has a really unique kind of proposition that I want to kind of get into later. But we usually start off by just getting some background. We don't do like these fancy intros. We let our guests kind of describe themselves. So Richard, give me the profile of what your career has looked like and you know, tell me kind of where you've been.
Sure, happy to. I've done a variety of different roles, which I think is one of the reasons that set me up to do well with this job, or, you know, running this business. I mostly worked in the high tech world with one particular company called Akamai Technologies. And within that company, I had spent time in sales roles, technical roles, product development, marketing, a lot of time in business development and mergers and acquisitions. With in business development side was really partnership focused. And the roles I had after I left Akamai were very similar positions, where I had a chance to really look at strategic issues, touch on a lot of different things across the whole breadth of running a business. So it set me up well for the position I'm in now.
Yeah, that's great. I remember, I think you had inquired on another listing that I had. I think it was a pretty small listing, and we got talking about it, and you gave me some background. I think in the time you told me, like, hey, I I ran M&A for, you know, a big corporation for a long time, and gave me some pretty staggering numbers in terms of the dollars of deals you had helped close for your business. And when I heard it, I was thinking about this potential listing that was coming up for this business called Yugster, which I thought was the strangest name. I was not familiar with it, even though we had sold it in the past, but Yugster was Yours Until Gone Stir. And it was Yugster.com. And Mark Dowse, the founder of Quiet Light, called me and said, "Hey, we sold this business like years and years ago. And now the guy that we sold it to is interested in selling it again and asked me if I would like to take a look at it." And so when you started talking and I could hear your operational background, I thought, this might be a good fit for you. And I think I just said, "Hey, I've got an idea I want to kind of float to you." And I feel like that's kind of how we started it. Is that what you remember?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I started looking for a business probably 6 or 9 months before you and I ever even touched base. Part of that was me doing homework on sort of what was out there and how to look at these, you know, businesses that are a lot smaller than the kinds of things that I'd looked at before, where we're talking, you know, sale prices in the nine figures, right? So very large businesses, large multiples because it's tech. And so I wasn't quite sure how to go about buying, frankly, a smaller business. And there's a lot of chaff out there. I mean, you know that, and you know, there's a lot of you know, brokers out there who have just put a listing out for anything. So you end up learning quite a bit about what's really there and what's meaningful just by going through that process. And we did look at a business for another e-com site that you had posted up there. And I think we had decided it was a little bit too seasonal for what we were doing. And then you threw the Yugster thing out there. I think it hadn't even gone public. And I'm like, Yugster, right? That's, you know, as a marketing guy, that was like, just, you don't even know what that is. But yeah, that's exactly the story. And so I think when I got my teeth around that one, it actually made a lot of sense for me. I was kind of excited by it.
Yeah. And correct me if I'm wrong, but so the business model was, it had been a drop shipping business, I think, since day one. And, you know, it still had a very impressive, you know, you're looking at it and I'm looking at the site and I'm thinking, this looks kind of antiquated. It looks a little bit like it's seen its better days. But when I looked at the results, you know, we're talking about a low eight figure business that was on some slightly declining trends. And I could just tell that the light bulb kind of went off for you about, like, I think I might be able to inject some life into this. And, you know, I clearly could see that you'd be able to handle the size of business it was from what you had done before. But what specifically about Yugster was interesting to you? Like, what was it when you first looked at it? What were you thinking? Like, this is a good fit for me because of what?
You know, when I, like I was saying, I went through this process where I started talking to some, you know, different brokers about a variety of different businesses, right, to help me get educated about what's out there. There's a lot of businesses out there that are, especially in the e-com space, that are really, you know, it's an Amazon store. You know, it's somebody who's, they're importing some private label from China, and then they're essentially listing it on Amazon, having Amazon do fulfillment and so forth. It doesn't, and the issue I got to is that it doesn't really leverage my skills. There's not a lot of value that you can add to some of those kind of businesses. Maybe you get a few more distribution channels or what have you. What I saw with Yugster was really interesting to me, that it was a fully operating business. Yes, it was dropship, but they had relationships with a sizable number of vendors. They had a functioning platform. They were not dependent on other marketplaces like Amazon, which, you know, can be all over the place, or eBay or whatever. They had their own storefront. It had been established, I think, in 2005, early 2006, when it went live. So it had a long, you know, life, which is really important in terms of longevity and the brand and so forth. And the other thing that the two other things that I really looked at and I liked about it, one was it had a core staff, right? There were talented people that had, you know, good resumes, seemed to know what they were doing. And it also had a really solid customer base. They had a loyalty program they'd run for many years. These were customers that had been buying from Yugster repeatedly, and they, you know, had tiered up, and they were kind of passionate about the business. And, you know, that, the sort of strong customer base, loyal customer base that's established, the staff that's there, and a technology platform that I thought I could really make a difference with, because I do have a strong tech background, All of those things kind of came together for me and made me want to dive in with Yester.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, of course, as just kind of a layperson, when I go to the site, I think of it as like a daily discount kind of idea. I see like a maybe a generation ago iPad or MacBook or something like that. Is it retail focused folks like me? Or is it more like small businesses that are like, hey, we need these, you know, iPads for our production floor, but we don't need the latest and greatest. We need to get 10 of this. You know, is it a mix of those types of customers, or, you know, who really is the customer that comes to this place?
Really good question. And it's changed a bit. So the business model, just to kind of flesh that out a little bit more for the audience, it is a daily deal site. And what that mostly involves is sort of inventory ends. So people might have, you know, a couple hundred or something left and they just want to get rid of it. It could be, there's a lot of refurbished product out there that, you know, like you're saying, is a year or two behind. And for most people, you know, do you need the latest and greatest Apple MacBook Pro, or is one that's 2 or 3 years old going to work just fine for you? Even to things like vacuums and what have you. And so there's a range of products, but we get them. We typically really focus on running them for a period of a few days. We sell out the inventory and then we move on to the next product and cycle through it. Our customers were historically very male, so 70-80% male buyers. The profile would be sort of bargain hunters, people that are, you know, somewhat shopaholic shows up in the mix as well. Since we've moved the business over to, I took it over last year, and we've kind of modified the site and the product mix, we're actually closer to 50-50 male-female at this point, because we have a lot more home goods than we used to. And one of the things, to your point about selling to businesses, I've actually noticed a significant increase in the number of orders from businesses. We really used to have only a small handful, but now I've seen things like schools, you know, like I've seen a school order like 20 Chromebooks from us. And they're going to use them with, you know, smaller kids, and they don't need the latest and greatest. They just need a laptop that the kid can work on. iPads, as you suggested, another great example. I've seen a bunch of those go out for businesses that are needing it, but, you know, the latest and greatest current generation isn't required for what they're doing. They're doing order entry or, you know, checking people out kind of thing. So, but it's definitely shifted. And I think some of that is the changes that we've made in the site and the business as well, which I think we'll get into at some point.
Yeah. You mentioned the staff. I kind of want to jump to that. So from what I recall, you're in Washington. Are you in the Seattle area?
I am, yeah.
Okay. Just and then this business was in Salt Lake, I believe. And there was a physical office there. And how many employees were in that office?
I want to say about 9.
Okay. And so what have you done with that? Have you kept that office there? Have you retained that staff? What have you done in terms of changing that since you bought the business?
Great question. So because of my background being in tech, most of my career, the majority of the people that I managed were actually remote, some as far away as China or India in different roles that I had. And so I'm very personally very comfortable running a remote staff. And so one of the things that we did is actually close that office because it wasn't adding much in the way of value and home office everybody. So the whole organization now is based out of their own homes. And we use a lot of G Suite technology, so a lot of video meetings, audio calls, whatever, Slack to communicate and stay very, very highly interactive between us. But everybody just works from home in their jammies or sweats or whatever they like at this point. So, and I think you asked about, did we keep the staff? And we kept 100% of the employees. We gave everybody a job offer as they came over because we wanted to really evaluate what they could do with different leadership and sort of re-energizing the business. And we've had some staffing turnover since, people that pursued other opportunities or maybe weren't the right fit for us where we were going. But I'd say about 80% of the staff is the same as what it was when I acquired the business.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, at Quiet Light, you know, we run a distributed team as well. And so we've got 8 brokers in the States. We've got 2 overseas. But it is an interesting time frame that we live in, you know, where I actually go to an office. If you see behind me, my house is not behind me, but I have 5 children at home. So that can be challenging at the house. So I choose to rent an office, but I do think it is interesting in this day and age that remote works so well. And I feel like as a general rule, people are happier when they can choose where they go to work, you know.
Absolutely. And I will actually tell you that when the last round of hiring we did was for some new buyers that we brought into the business, and the ability for both of them to work from home was actually a big, big competitive advantage in getting them to come on board.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. So, you know, we don't really use this as like a sales pitch, but as you're sitting there talking about what you guys do, I mean, our listeners, you know, we have a lot of listeners to this podcast, and a lot of them are, you know, small entrepreneurial shops. Some are like PE firms, and then you've got your like solo entrepreneurs. So I'm just kind of curious, you know, where do our listeners kind of fit into the kind of product mix that you guys offer at your business? You know, like what are the types of things that they might be most interested in that you sell on a daily basis now?
Sure. I mean, I would say, you know, for that kind of audience, you're probably looking at mostly the technology and maybe some of the home goods, for example. So on the tech side, you know, we sell all kinds of computers, Windows and Macs, desktops, laptops, Chromebooks, iPads, and even phones. Obviously, that technology suite is something that just about every entrepreneur or business will need to some degree. If you're somebody that's looking for, like I said, the absolute latest and greatest, it's not going to be on our site. I mean, I'll be upfront. Like, we don't sell the latest MacBooks at all. Almost all of our tech in that sense is refurbished, and you pay for what you get. I mean, if you're buying a refurbished laptop and you're buying, you know, $300 for a MacBook, it's going to be older. But for an awful lot of people that are simply doing email, that kind of thing, that works just fine. And we also have a range where we go from, let's say, a MacBook at $300 all the way up to a MacBook at $1,200. So you get to choose sort of what level you want and what you really need, but they're generally some pretty good bargain prices in terms of the type of technology and look that people are after. Home goods side, I mean, coffee bar, right? I mean, if you got a home office, everybody needs coffee. You can't function without it. And so one of our vendors, awesome vendor, is the exclusive factory refurbished provider for Ninja products. Ninja makes some incredible home appliances. They have this great little Ninja coffee bar. That's sort of a single serving, fresh ground, coffee maker. And, you know, they sell like crazy. People love them. And so, yeah, I think there are some tech products and some home products that would be a good fit for any business person.
Yeah, that's great. I want to get into some of the changes that you've made, but one thing I want to kind of back up to that kind of struck me, not something I've seen that often, was your deal structure. I remember talking to you and kind of floating you the price, and you said, "Yeah, I'm a cash buyer, so you know we can leverage that, no problem." And then when we got to the LOI, you called me and said, "Hey, I think I'm going to utilize some SBA on this, and I'm going to put down way more than what they'll require, but I've got an SBA lender that I want to tap into." I just kind of like for you to explain to our listeners, kind of as much as you're willing to share about that process, what your thinking was, and like, basically how you kind of navigated that SBA process.
Yeah, actually, that's a really good question, because I guess it is a little bit unique. You know, I did have the cash going in to have paid 100% of it down. The issue for me really was, just in one word, flexibility. Being able to conserve my capital, put down enough to be meaningful, so the SBA approval process was a no-brainer, but and not be running really tight on sort of the amount of down payment I did, but keeping a good chunk of reserve capital, because there's always been sort of a possibility that I might acquire other businesses that would add on to this as well. And you want to have that flexibility in place. And I also wanted to make sure that once I had acquired the business, I didn't want to have used all the capital for the acquisition. Obviously, you need operating capital and you would build that into any plan. But I also wanted to be in a situation where I had enough investment capital inside the business that I could invest in the company and make the changes that I wanted. And so when I looked at the overall sort of combination of things, it made a lot of sense to sort of mix this up a little bit and take, I think I would have to look at the paperwork again, but I think we did something like 40% down cash and 60% finance. And what that essentially did for me is mean that within the business, I had a good chunk of capital available to pay for, you know, all the technology changes and sort of enhancements that we wanted to make to move the business forward, because we knew we would need to do that going in.
Yeah, and I found it very interesting. So SBA, you know, we have just a massive number of people reaching out to us looking for SBA eligible businesses and wanting to talk to us about it. And I will say that one of the common pitfalls that I think that our buyers kind of find themselves in is trying to maximize the SBA situation for themselves. So a person thinks, okay, on the high level point, an SBA loan can be a 10% down kind of situation. That's in the absolute most ideal scenario would be a 10% down. So someone has, you know, $250,000 in capital that they can put down on a business. And so their mind immediately goes to, okay, then I'll buy a $2.5 million business. And what I've kind of found over time doing these SBA deals is that those end up being a tough deal. If anything goes even remotely wrong, then now all of a sudden the deal is falling apart. You know, maybe the valuation doesn't come back high enough. Maybe there's more inventory than was expected and SBA can't cover the inventory. So you were the first person that I've had do that. And I've had a couple people do it since, but you're the first person that came and said, hey, I can pay cash, but I'm going to go ahead and use SBA. And honestly, I think SBA has a lot of advantages and a lot of disadvantages. The advantages are from a broker standpoint, really opens up our buying pool. We can offer something as an SBA, you know, we really open up the number of buyers that can come in. But for the seller, SBA can be a grind to get through, especially in these situations where people are putting down the minimum amount. I think what you did was interesting, because I never got a single phone call from the SBA lender in your deal. I never heard anything about it. You kept me updated on kind of where things are going. And that is not typical for what we deal with at Quiet Light. A lot of times we're introducing them to an SBA lender, and then we're getting the play-by-play and we're delivering information back to the sellers about what's going on. In your case, you said, I'm going to use SBA. I thought you put down 50%, maybe you put down 40%. I can't remember, but you put down a big chunk and just said, I want the flexibility. And I think that really proved to show, it was just a really wise move on your part from a business decision. And it didn't hold us up at all. We literally got that thing closed right on time, where we were expecting in terms of timing, at least the way that I had kind of set the expectations for our seller. So,
yeah, I would just add to that, Brad. I think, you know, the advice I'd give anyone considering buying a business is get your house in order. I think one of the reasons the SBA process on our side went smoothly was because our finances and sort of our credit rating, everything was cleaned up so that there was nothing weird on our credit reports. It was all sort of looking pretty, and, you know, accounts that needed to be closed or resolved were done. So when the bank looked at things, they, you know, they look at your credit report, they look at your house, they look at your mortgage, your payment histories. You want to be able to give them a very clean, robust picture and be able to give it to them. Boom, here it is. And then we also had a very clear picture of the financials and what we were going to do with the business. We gave them a 30-page business plan that essentially laid out, you know, here's the financials, here's what we're going to invest in, here's the changes we're going to make, here's the timeline, here's the results. And they were conservative, right? They weren't sort of wild, willy-nilly kind of things. And so between getting our own personal numbers kind of cleaned up, and this is everything just from like credit numbers to even just having a nice, clean resume, right? I mean, you're applying to SBA. They want to see your business history, what you've done. So you can't take the resume that you used for your job 5 years ago and just slap it down. It's got to show the bank that you know how to run a business. And so there's a lot of little things that you can do to get ready. And so we had those in place before you and I even got into this acquisition process. The other comment I would add about doing the sort of 10% down, I mean, we could have gotten approved on a bigger deal at 10% down. I would never have done it in a million years. And part of this maybe comes from my M&A experience, which is obviously a lot larger kind of mix. But one thing I've learned is that no matter how good you are at diligence, no matter, you know, what you know about this particular industry, any business you have is going to have some surprises and it's going to have some ups and downs, right? And so one of the problems I see with people that would be doing sort of this 10% and sort of right on the bleeding edge, you're not going to have enough capital to be really flexible. You're going to struggle with investments. And here's, and this maybe not something that people don't really think about that much, but buying a business is stressful, right? You're running a new business, you're investing, this is your whole, potentially your whole income, your life, what you're doing, good chunk of your personal assets are going to get tied up in it. It's stressful even if you have tons of money to play with. Putting yourself right on the edge where your finances are squeezed that tight, where you're doing 10% down and that's all everything that you've got, it just adds to the stress level in a way that's not good for running the business. It's not good for you personally on a health basis. So I think, you know, if I can look back at it and say, you know, give what's my advice to people to get through an acquisition process using SBA, prepare, right? Good credit, cleaned up, get all your documentation in order, get your resume all pretty and all that stuff. But don't squeeze yourself so tight that you don't have flexibility, you don't have capital to invest, you're going to panic if you have any ups and downs. It's not worth it. That's too much stress where you really want to be thinking clearly, being able to make smart decisions with some perspective on it. And, you know, you and I'm sure know this, Brad, it's really hard to make perspective when you're tight on the finances and you're panicking, right? So that was, I mean, all of those things factored into sort of where I went to, but I would definitely encourage people to make sure they've got enough of a cushion and flexibility to run their business confidently.
No, I totally share your thoughts on that. And in my operating days, that's really exactly how we tried to run, you know, the business. If you don't have a good amount of cash on hand, it just makes something that's already difficult to do, running a business, that much more difficult and puts additional strain on you whenever you get some of those unknown kind of problems that come up. You know, one of the things I remember about you, I don't refer to you by name, but I tell people, one time I sold a business to this M&A guy that had done a lot of corporate deals. And let me tell you something, if you think that diligence folder that you saw today is involved, I should show you his because I remember it was a thorough deck of information. You had that thing all laid out perfectly. It was like, okay, you know, one of the things I think I learned there is the pros have seen everything. So when you laid out that diligence folder and I saw it, I was like, it was organized. It was great. I mean, there was nothing wrong with it. It was a lot. It was a lot of information. You're very thorough, very detailed, and it kind of makes sense to me that it's gone well for you, you know, doing this business. Okay. I want to get into, so I was thinking about doing some podcast episodes and I think I emailed you maybe a month ago and said, hey, I went to Yugster and there's no more Yugster. So talk about the rebrand and then let's talk about some other changes that you made.
I mean, Yugster had a cult following behind it and, you know, cult followings are great. There's a lot of loyalty that goes into that. But it was not a brand that was going to work well to sort of reach out to a larger audience. And so we, you know, the team, right? So I got the leadership team that was in place. One of the first things we did was restructure internally to kind of give them really clean roles and responsibilities, you know, in purchasing and marketing, because it had all been sort of blurred before. And what we then took off and did is really sit down and think about the kinds of changes we wanted to make in the business. The brand was a big piece of it. And we did really dig in on the idea of keeping the Yugster brand, but we also knew that we needed to give it a refresh, improve the look and feel of the website and sort of get it to a healthier sort of message and you know, make it more attractive to people. In the end, when we kind of dug through it, Yugster as a brand itself wasn't going to scale for us. It wasn't going to bring in a larger audience that we were sort of now starting to pursue and chase. So we spent some time doing, you know, to figure out what brand you want to work with, see what domain names are out there. We knew we wanted a .com. We also knew that we wanted to keep a little synergy with Yugster. We didn't want to go too far away from it. And so, as you mentioned in the beginning, Yugster had become Yours Until Gone, and Yug would show up throughout the branding of the site. The loyalty program was called Yug Points. There was a lot of Yug that showed up. And so we figured if we kept the Until Gone piece of it, that would be a nice connection. And so turned out that that brand or that domain was actually available for purchase, which is where we made some of our capital investment, was actually buying that domain name. And it's worked out great. I would say that the marketing team did, it could be a case study, frankly, in the rebranding going from Yugstirred until Gone. I won't say everything was perfect, but it was as good as I've ever seen it done in what the team put together, and it was fantastic. We had a few customers that didn't make it over, but the vast majority did, and we went live with the new Until Gone site, which we can talk about some of the software stuff we did here in a second, on September 1st. And I can tell you, Brad, if I showed you the detailed financials, you'll see them start to grow through the summer. And then there's this inflection point, September 1st, where they just kick up and you start seeing this nice steady growth curve. And I think a lot of it had to do with, we made changes over the summer to the Yugstirred site to clean it up, make it a little bit more polished. But there's only so much that we were able to do. Once we went to the new site, which was a completely revamped look and feel and brand, I think it, for all the customers that we were bringing in, it just gave them confidence. That look and feel was a lot more professional, a lot more polished than the old site had been. And while we lost some of the cult kitschiness that was tied in with Yugstirred, I think the more professional site appealed to a much larger group who were more willing to buy and make purchases through the site. And that's why we see the growth. And that's continued to accelerate as we came into 2019.
Yeah, when I saw it, actually, so I was kind of going through my list of deals and, you know, I've closed 20 deals at Quiet Light, you know, since I've been here. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of just looking at it and trying to think about, you know, what would be good podcast episodes. So I had gotten through 14 of them or so when I hit Yugstirred. And as soon as I hit it and went to the site, I was just like, I know there's a story here. Cause I mean, it does, it looks fantastic. I remembered what the old site looked like. I see what the new one looks like. It's like, I could totally get that you were very thoughtful about how you approached it, how you kind of kept that Until Gone. I think that was really smart. So I totally could see the thought process from a marketer's standpoint of what you were doing. And it seems to me like it did go really well just from an optics, you know, standpoint on my part. So it doesn't surprise me that your trends are good. We're getting somewhat short on time. Let's get into the software a little bit. I want to know what kinds of changes you've made to the stack and, you know, just kind of go wherever you want with that. But I kind of want to know what you've been doing there.
Yeah, we could make a podcast about that in and of itself. There were some really interesting lessons learned, I guess. But I'll try to keep it focused for the group because probably not everyone's a techie. But basically, we have replaced 100% of the stack at this point. The original plan had been to upgrade the existing stack and put a new front end on it, the new Until Gone front end, basically. And then do a bunch of work around creating APIs and what APIs are for anyone who's not familiar with it. They are programmatic interfaces that allow third parties to engage with your site. And so, for example, we wanted our vendors, our partners who were doing shipping, to be able to work with us via API rather than exchanging text files, CSVs, for example. And the reason for that is just sort of accuracy, speed, time to market, and so forth. And there were lots of opportunities to do that, to help our vendors and ourselves, frankly, work better together. Once we got into the details and we started looking at the Until Gone site design and what we wanted to do, it would have required too many changes to the existing platform that would have left behind, in all honesty, a lot of stuff that we still needed to change. And so I think we closed the deal the first week of May last year, May 7th, 2018. By the end of June, we had made the decision to do a full stack replacement top to bottom. And so we sourced a company actually here in Seattle to do a new website front end design, and to then actually do the implementation on Shopify.
Nice.
And we're on Shopify Plus because we're large enough that we need to be on the bigger platform with the capabilities that they give us. And then that meant that we had to build a new backend because with the number of vendors we work with the way we work, with the flexibility we wanted to do, It would not have been possible for us to just rely on Shopify. Now, that won't be the case for a lot of e-commerce vendors, but we operate a lot like a marketplace. And we need to process a lot of purchase orders out to our vendors and take products in, and not every product goes on the site and so forth. So we had to have control over that back end. And so essentially we built out a completely new platform stack that operates. There's an admin portal. There's a huge amount of infrastructure for integrating with Shopify and providing all the APIs that we essentially built out. And what we've done since then is build some custom APIs. We've integrated with ShipStation, which is a shipping management tool that a lot of our vendors utilize. We've integrated with Channel Advisor. We've integrated with a great company called Quipt, which is similar to Channel Advisor, but a little bit more technology focused. And we're finalizing an integration with Seller Cloud, which is another one of these integrator platforms that a lot of vendors and suppliers utilize. And so that's given us just a huge amount of flexibility, because it was sort of getting rid of a lot of the dead wood that had existed previously. We've been able to do things that we weren't able to do previously that really take advantage of technology to reach our customers better. And so, you know, some examples of that, we actually built a little ad engine so that we could serve up our own products as ads to our customers in notification emails. We've done things with targeting, where we've essentially built kind of a, you can think of it as a mini CRM, customer relationship management platform, where the marketing emails that we send to them are fully targeted to their interests, their likes, what they prefer. Each of these changes, as we've gotten into the stack, have given us sort of an incremental growth and helped us, you know, improve that curve, show better metrics, and have better control. It's also allowed us to really tightly integrate with our vendors. And we continue to invest in it. We have some new capabilities coming out this week, frankly, that we want to get in place before Q4 that will allow us to do some things that will really improve our shipping and our customer service related to that, because that's always a big issue with customers. So I'm happy to get into more detail, Brad, but I don't want to take up the time just talking about coding and Google Cloud and what we did. That's not the focus here.
No, I think you hit some great highlights there. And actually, it's been interesting to watch Shopify and its kind of dominance really in the kind of hosted, you know, stores platform. You know, as I think WordPress as a CMS is now like 35% of the world's websites. And I can tell you from my perspective of, you know, operating for many years and kind of coming from that custom website world where we built everything from scratch because it gave us more flexibility, and then seeing the kind of out of the box solutions come on the scene, and then seeing Shopify and Volusion and Wix and these other players come on the scene. But it really seems like Shopify has asserted some dominance in the space at this point. I'll be speaking at an event in San Diego next month. And at that event, it's Shopify sellers. I'm going on a podcast in 2 weeks. It's just Shopify folks that work with Shopify every day. And we find a lot of our sellers now, when they have high margin products, are really utilizing the Facebook pixel for marketing. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, Shopify plus the Facebook pixel is just the combo that everyone wants to use. It's just, Shopify's just kind of become this, I think of it kind of like WordPress for the CMS. I feel like Shopify is kind of becoming the e-commerce shopping cart or store hosted platform, you know, for the e-com side. Did you have any struggle with choosing to go with Shopify? Was there any, you know, was that a tough decision for you?
No, not really. I mean, I think we really looked at Shopify and BigCommerce were really the sort of two that we were down to at that point. We did look at Magento, which is, you know, both a platform that you can just, it's open source and build your own, but they also have a hosted option. That was much more complicated and had a tech stack that we weren't sure we really wanted to work with. But it really came down to Shopify versus BigCommerce. And honestly, it was a combination of the partner we ended up wanting to work with was more comfortable with Shopify. And we also looked at Shopify and felt, like you're saying, given their market share and their size, it was a good fit. And I think it made sense to do that. I will say I came from a platform world, so I'm very comfortable with using these kinds of platforms. And you know, I will say there's trade-offs. There's huge positives. As an example of a positive, I wanted to implement Apple Pay on the site. And you know, our payment processor already supported, so I did all the things I needed to do with Apple, hooked it up with my payment processor, went into Shopify, one check mark, and it's live and ready to go. The Facebook pixel is another one, right? You configure the Facebook stuff in Shopify, it's done like that. Google Analytics, same thing. And so there's a lot of functionality that's built into the platform that you don't have to customize, that you don't have to tweak, but you can still change things like your notification emails to make them personalized for your look and feel. So I think there's some really great things there in working with a platform. The flip side, there is some loss of control. You don't have necessarily quite the same flexibility. There was a feature we were talking about the other day in my management team's meeting. The reality was, if it was on our platform, we could do it in a skinny minute. It's just on Shopify. It's going to be difficult to get it live and implemented. Not because of anything I say would be a real flaw with Shopify, but just because when someone else is running a platform, there's sort of, you know, some constraints that you get into it. But I'm comfortable with the Shopify decision. I think I'd make the same one again. I think given their size, given the number of big brands that are using them now, it's a good solid fit. So yeah, I would go there again.
Okay. And one of the things I was kind of wanting to at least ask was biggest challenge. You know, what's been the biggest, unforeseen kind of thing that you have had to tackle, at least that you're comfortable sharing?
Sure. I mean, there's always surprises in acquiring any business, and challenges are going to come up. You know, you end up having to do more of something than you expected and so forth. And it, you know, kind of throws you. I would say in this case, I was actually probably the biggest challenge was the technology side, not because it was inherently a bad decision or difficult to rebuild the platform and do what we did. It was absolutely the right decision. I guess the point I would make is we weren't expecting to make that decision for 12 months. It was kind of something we were looking at as a 2019 project, and it ended up being a 2018 project. And so what I had actually hoped to do was use the existing platform and, like I said, give it a facelift, redo the front end, make it into Until Gone, but rely on the same core operational platform and just maybe do a few extensions. And it didn't end up being possible to get where I knew that we needed to be from a marketing, branding, capability perspective. We had to make the changes. And so, you know, basically from July through the end of September, it was heads down coding. I wrote more code in those 2 months than I think I had in the previous 10, 20 years.
Oh, wow.
You know, because my career has not been as a coder. I've been, you know, in sort of management. So, but we had to build a completely new platform from scratch. And so it was a lot of stuff that we were putting together to make it work. And that continued through Q4 and, you know, even into this year as we add new features. And like I said earlier, now we're at a point where we're really adding some really unique, distinctive capabilities. We've even thought about spinning out some businesses to take the stuff that we've built. And Shopify has this huge app ecosystem. Apps that you can plug into Shopify and extend its core capabilities. A lot of what we've now built are things that are unique and not available within that ecosystem. And so we think there's some opportunities just to extend that and make that a sort of additional part of the business. But I would say that was my number one sort of challenge, or I guess surprise in sort of what we did. And you know, at times it's taken me away from running the business in a way that I wanted to. But I think it's ended up, like I said, being in a good place at this point.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I do think the Shopify kind of app marketplace is pretty vibrant. We had a lead come through a couple of weeks ago that we were discussing among the team. It was a collection of some apps, and I think it was bringing in about $80,000 a month in recurring
revenue from a group that had built several apps in the space. So I do think that there's a pretty large market there to tap into. So, well, I really want to thank you for coming on the show today. It's really helpful to our audience. I hope it ends up being, you know, helpful to you. People reach out to me all the time when I'm on these podcasts. So I hope that you get to make some good connections from coming on and giving us some of your time. Do you have any parting pieces of advice for those looking to buy or sell an online-based business?
I guess since I haven't sold a business of this size, I'll maybe not sort of give advice on that just yet. But as a buyer, I would say don't sit on the fence. It's one of the best things that you can possibly do of, you know, getting out of corporate life. Find a broker that you trust, that you like, that you can build a relationship with. Tell them what you're looking for. Don't make stuff up or blow smoke or try to sound bigger than you are. Be honest with them. Tell the broker what you're looking for, what your strengths are, what kind of things would keep you engaged and challenged, so they have a good idea, because their job is to connect you. So if you don't give them the honest picture, they can't help you. But don't hesitate. Owning your own business, running your own destiny, I think is something that's just, it's fantastic. It's challenging. It can be, you know, scary at times, but if you're thinking about it, go for it. And I definitely liked working with Brad. He was always a straight shooter and honest. And I'm not saying this just because you're on, I'd say this to anybody, but, you know, finding a broker that's a straight shooter, that's honest, that's upfront, makes it easy. That's huge. And I loved working with Quiet Light and Brad, and I would definitely do it again if I had another business to go after.
I appreciate that. And honestly, you were one of the easiest buyers that I've ever worked with. I mean, you brought all this experience to the table, and honestly, you know, that is what we do. We're matching people up a lot of times. That's the game that we're playing. And we may or may not be helpful in the other aspects of it, but really to do well as a business advisor at Quiet Light, we really need to be able to listen to what people are telling us they want, and then pair that up with things that we have, you know, that are for sale. And I don't know that I take a whole lot of credit for it, but I do think that you were the perfect person to take over this business. And I'm really glad to hear that it's going really well for you. And I hope that you continue to have success in the future.
Thank you, Brad. I think it was a good fit. And I hope the improvement we're seeing continues. It's a great course we're on, and I appreciate your help making this connection happen.
Thanks a lot for coming on today, Richard. We really appreciate it. For the listeners, we will see you the next time. Thank you.
Today's podcast was produced by Podcast Motor and the Quiet Light content team. If you have a suggestion for a future podcast, or if you want to guess the quote from the beginning of the show for a chance at getting a shout out on the pod, email us at podcast@quietlightbrokerage.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel and this show wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.